Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there, whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, March 25th, 2024, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebig with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska.
And I'm Guy Hero, and Katrina, methinks I've become enamored of an ass fish. The bony-eared ass fish, that is.
Awesome. And we have two guests. Peter Oster is a senior research scientist with the Mystic Aquarium and a research professor emeritus with the University of Connecticut at Avery Point's Department of Marine Sciences. And Brittany Peterson was the superintendent of the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument prior to her current tenure as a visual and design branch manager at our National Conservation Training Center. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank
Good you. Good to be here.
Brittany, you reached out and we're like, we want to cover the ass fish. I was like, finally, we get to do this. Why this fish and why not some other fish that you've come across?
Yeah, it goes back to the 2021 stepping stone dive with the Okeanos. My background's as a terrestrial biologist doing land management. And so I'm getting my feet wet, literally and physically. And I'm sitting in on this group chat with a bunch of scientists, including Peter here, while they're doing these dives on the New England seamounts. And the chat just exploded with this reference to an ass fish. And I had to pause and be like, is this a real thing? Or is this like one of those made up names that scientists do for like just fun? And to find out that it actually is the commonly accepted name for fish, it just like, it hooked me.
I told my 6-year-old that we were recording ass fish and he was very excited and asked if he could say the fish's name and is like super pumped for this episode to come out. So future ass fish researcher in the house.
Yeah, excellent.
I'm curious, why does this fish have the name that it does?
So this species was first described from a specimen collected during the Challenger expeditions, one of the first global oceanographic expeditions sent out from the United Kingdom back in the years 1872 to 1876. And soon after that, a German ichthyologist named Albert Gunther published the description in 1878, and he gave it the name Acanthonus armatus. The armatus part comes from armored in Latin, the scientific species name, and that's likely due to the spines that are on its snout, on its nose, and the operculum, the bony plate that covers the gills, got really very pointy, long spines. And the acanthonus part comes from ancient Greek for prickly, again, owning to the spines, and then onus could either mean a hake related to the cod, which that whole group of fish are, but also it can mean donkey. In Greek, the homonym of the Greek word for ass, hence the bony-eared ass fish as a accepted common name. And what little boy from the age of 3 to at least 67 isn't enamored by the name bony-eared ass fish? I'm enamored.
I've actually been wanting to cover this fish for a long time based on its name. And I'm kind of curious if you think the name has actually helped its notoriety at all.
Oh, absolutely. I think it was the Cal Academy of Sciences that had a display of deep sea fishes, and one of them was dead fish in a jar, but of the bony-eared ass fish, and it got all kinds of press. It's a good poster child for taxonomy and systematics and understanding the relationships of fishes that live in the deep sea. I lost count how many times I said ass.
We'll count at the end.
Ass?
Once we do that,
okay.
That's true.
Excellent. The bony-eared ass fish, keep track how many times I say this, is a cuscheal, and it's related to a diverse group of species in the deep sea. Large bony head, and then actually relatively short, tapering tail. Its flesh is kind of soft and flabby, and its bone structure has pretty low density, and that's kind of owing to pressures that it lives under and the limited amount of food that it would find in the deep ocean. It would be a great Muppet character. Actually,
I also think it looks like a tadpole, you know, kind of that big old bulbous head, long tail.
Yeah.
It really does kind of look like a hake. So, you know, even though people have glommed on to this ass fish name, I do think that kind of the original intention probably was that hake-like or cod-like description. Do you guys know when the term assfish really kind of began to take hold within the scientific community as the accepted common name?
Back in the 1970s, the American Fisheries Society published a list of accepted common names that are used beyond the scientific name, genus and species. Common names are very loose, so it was useful to select a common name that could be used throughout the literature. I still got the paper version of it sitting on a bookshelf in my office.
I think the one that became the type specimen that they found initially, that was off of New Guinea, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. From the Challenger expedition. And that was collected in something like 2,000 meters of water. And doing that with the technology available at the time had to be a lot of backbreaking work.
Okay, so this fish, we know it's in New Guinea, and then you guys are both working off the northeast coast of the U.S., and those are two very different places. So what is the range of this fish, and what are the different habitat types around the world where you're able to find this thing?
This is globally distributed in tropical and subtropical seas in the deep ocean. So that's very cold water, 4 degrees C and lower principally. Its depth range is from about 2,000 to certainly over 4,000 meters depth. So it's living in the dark in a place has very low density of food. Like other cusk eels, it probably eats seafloor organisms. It's rare everywhere. It's globally distributed, multiple ocean basins around the world. Like I said, New Guinea, Central Atlantic. I've seen them southwest of the Azores. And here in the North Atlantic on a research cruise with NOAA ship Okeanos Explorer and the D2 deep ROV. You don't see them in schools or aggregations, and you see one on one dive and one on another dive. We did 20 something dives in 2021 on the Western North Atlantic and saw 3 fish. But seeing this alive is rare. There was some deep trawling work by unfortunately departed colleague in the northern Gulf of Mexico back in the 70s. In the deeper parts of the Gulf of Mexico, only turned up 9 of these bony-eared assfish. They didn't call it bony-eared assfish in the paper. They called it Acanthonus omatus because it was sciency. I would say it's restricted to the deep ocean, but the population is everywhere, but it's small. But they're obviously reproducing somewhere, which would mean at least 2 of them need to get together.
Blue Planet and others to kind of capture the assfish in its larval stage. It is a very different looking fish than what it later looks like in life. It's actually quite gorgeous with these fin-like projections that come off and almost airy and flowy. It's really quite stunning. And so Blue Planet actually has some great photos of it in that larval stage and pretty shallow areas too. So we know that they're reproducing somehow and have these beautiful larval phases and then go to more of that tadpole looking phase of life.
It's neat how larval fishes can look so different than the parents. We were talking with a researcher who was working with ocean sunfish, the molas, and their juveniles look very different.
There are also images from right off the beach in Florida. Sport divers, photographers would go out night diving out in the Straits of Florida. And so it's adjacent to very deep water. And animals would migrate from deep water to the surface at night and see all these incredibly Dr. Seussian looking organisms. Like Brittany said, it's got these long flowing fins that it probably uses to not sink in the water column. But it's similar to other cusk eel larvae, which we've seen actually in very deep water, using their tail to the sail with the assfish. These long flowing fins would even make a much better sail to be able to minimize energy for swimming, but staying in places where there's food. Because the more you can eat and the less energy you use, the bigger you can get quicker. The key to survival is get big as fast as you can to avoid being eaten.
Are there any other species of assfish, or is this the only one that we have?
Sure. So of the assfish that are out there is the Galathea, the Gluten, the Cavernous, the Bizzle, the Robust, and the Mozambique assfish. And I really think the Robust one is kind of cool because it gives a whole new meaning to that's a big assfish.
They've been doing their exercises.
Yeah. Doing a lot of squats.
Yeah.
Do these other species, do they also have that Onos or Onus in their genus name?
They're slightly different. The bony-eared assfish is one of the first described assfish. And then everything kind of fell underneath that. So there are just other assfish out there that got grouped together. So there very well could be, as I would like to say, a streak, the collective noun I'm, you know, bargaining for, of bony-eared assfish out there.
Okay, so hypothetically speaking, we get a new species. And I know you probably want to bake in whatever the physical appearance of the fish is, but assuming it can be whatever you want, what would you name your new assfish?
The bear assfish.
Oh, that's a good one. How would you spell bear?
B-E-A-R, just to really make it confusing.
There you go.
Because maybe you'll be found on bear seamount. Who knows?
The full moon assfish. You tell us a little more information in terms of what it's like to be in a submersible or what it's like to operate one of these ROVs and actually see these fish through the lens of those two different kind of deep ocean tools that we have.
I've actually only seen them with an ROV. I've done a lot of submersible dives, but not in those depths. The nice thing about an ROV is you can participate in every dive every day, where you wouldn't want to jam yourself in a submersible every day. Just it would be too physically taxing. Even the pilots cycle through. You're on a large boat, and instead of launching the occupied submersible, you're launching the remotely operated vehicle. So we've seen them sitting in the control van on the ship on a nice big screen, and you can talk to lots of other experts during each dive. The students always have if they're only looking at ROV video, they often have a bit of a spatial disconnect because they don't have that 3D eye to brain perspective from actually being there. So I think being in a submersible, at least initially in a study area or in a particular kind of landscape, is useful for being able to think about the three-dimensional relationships of organisms. And that makes interpreting the ROV video much easier. The nice thing about the ROV is you can get up and go pee, or you can go get a cup of coffee, where it's much more difficult to do either of those things if you're stuffed in a submersible. We've got these incredible cameras, very high resolution, very long zoom lengths, and you're sending back this high def video via satellite to high speed internet. So you can get really high resolution views of these animals. You can focus on the spines, or you can focus on the eyes, and you could be at a distance where you're not bumping into it to be able to see what it's doing. Coming up with something the size of a school bus with all these lights blasting probably influences their behavior. But when you come upon them, we see them in the habitat, and often you can see, and this is cusk eels writ large, that they've been doing something. Like, some of them have mud on their snouts. They've been rooting around in the seafloor. Their eyes are not huge because they're not using vision to search for things, but their proprioceptive system, their lateral lines, their senses, small pressure changes to be able to sense nearby prey is probably very acute. This large vehicle making noises coming at it. I mean, they don't go zipping off, but they also don't do a lot of things like right in front of you either. These are often fleeting glimpses, and then we go off and do something else.
Just to add on to what Peter was saying, my first experience with the assfish was back in 2021 with the NOAA Okeanos New England Stepping Stone expedition that was following the New England seamount chain and doing deep dives on those seamounts. And that is where they saw one of the more recent bony-eared assfish photos. Really quite an experience of thinking about this live televised dive from the middle of the Atlantic Ocean out in this high seas area, the snowman's land, and televising live action back to shore. I was, right after COVID, sitting down at my computer, getting my feel for the first deep dive. And it was quite a cool experience getting to think about, here's exploration of this deep sea, this area that we know very little about. So while they are rare, there's also this big gap of information about what do we even know about the deep sea? What do we know about these deep creatures and these deep habitats beyond like our previous tools? And with this increased technology, we're starting to find more and more about how fascinating these creatures are. It's quite an experience of getting to sit at your computer screen and like be 14,000 feet deep in the Atlantic Ocean and seeing these crazy cool critters that you would never, ever get to encounter any other way. I don't know what it's like to be in a submersible, but at least on an ROV dive, I'm sure it's quite a cool experience. And to think that there are these dives happening all the time across the world that anyone can tune into to keep an eye out for these bony-eared ass fish or other cool deep sea creatures. This is really fun to think about.
Well, and then even seeing them live, all of humanity has probably seen something less than 30 live bony-eared ass fish. So this is kind of like, you know, camera traps, looking at rare animals on land, getting the first glimpses of some of these things live. And shining light on these things so we can see them where they live is a very unique experience. And like Brittany said, that these can be shared via the internet all over the world is a very modern experience.
Ong ong, everyone. It's time for Minute with Maria. I'm Maria Dosal, calling in from Chogyang Lands here in Dillingham, Alaska. And I wanted to take a moment to give credence to the wonderful ass fish. Thank you to our guest, Big Huge Kagasakung, for discussing the ass fish with us. And what is in a name? I really just want to talk about really quick how many conversations can get started with just mentioning the ass fish. Hearing about the national monuments, for example, is so wonderful. I'm so happy that we have these strongholds in place so that we can protect our marine resources so that the animals and the ecosystems can thrive. Just talking about this species, and there's a lot to be discovered. It's a testament to how much more we can learn. And so with that being said, I'm so happy that we brought ass fish to the table, and it's a discussion that we all can learn more from and hopefully spark more conversation about conservation. So thank you to our wonderful guests for talking to us about ass fish. Kagasakung.
Usually when I'm thinking about the Fish and Wildlife Service, we're talking about freshwater fish, we're on land. So what is the Marine National Monument System? What can you tell us about this monument in particular?
So as Katrina said, previously I had served as the superintendent of the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument, which is a marine monument. There are national monuments on land. Think of Mount Rushmore, for example. But then there are also these marine national monuments. The one in the Northeast is the first one in the Atlantic. It's about 3.1 million acres. It is 120 miles offshore of Cape Cod in the U.S.'s exclusive economic zone. So it's these two units. One is a canyons unit. One is a seamounts unit that includes these deep sea canyons deeper than the Grand Canyon. And these seamounts that rival anything east of the Rockies, which is just a really cool thing. It's all underwater, or as I like to describe it, land covered by wet air. It's one of five marine national monuments. There's also the Marianas, there's the Papahanaumokuakea, and several out in the Pacific. This just happens to be the first one in the Atlantic, and they're set aside to be co-managed between the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, to work as marine conservation areas and put these areas into protection and maintain those habitats and a lot of the spaces in between for those marine species that we have.
And are there ass fish in the monument?
We haven't seen it yet. I have hopes of seeing an ass fish in a monument someday. And that's why I tune into the deep sea dives, just in case I get to be an ass fish spotter. Yeah.
Species distribution modeling would suggest that they could occur there. So yeah, we have our eyes peeled.
I'm curious. So when was this designated as a marine national monument?
It was established in 2016. Peter had been working on it for many years prior to its establishment. And the way I describe it is the proximity of these seamounts. So the only seamounts within the U.S.'s exclusive economic zone are right near these canyons. It just so happens that the Gulf Stream is coming nearby, and then you have this cold water current coming from the Nova Scotia area and bringing all this cold water down. You have these two currents meeting, and you have these sea mountains underneath there and these canyons that are causing all these upwellings that are bringing nutrients to the surface. And something about that combination of the geography under that water is causing a really nutrient biodiverse place. So because of that, and it also is bringing in these warm currents, which allows for these deep sea coral systems to form, which most people don't think of deep sea corals or corals off of New England. But you have these extremely tall, colorful corals that get no light, but yet thrive and survive and can be thousands of years old. So it's this really cool system that just remains a curiosity to so many in the scientific community of just like understanding how these marine systems function and work. As much as we know about our stars and our solar system, we know very little about our own ocean. So tying this all together, it serves as a good research location and like a place to understand what this world is all about, at least in the ocean space, and serves as a place for researchers. And then also just, you know, let us understand how these systems work and how the species there work.
So, I mean, it's a great place for researchers, like you've mentioned, also protected area. What are the types of threats that deep water fishes might face, and how are these monuments helping with those?
The monument is the surface to the seafloor. So there's also marine mammals, seabirds, and all those species that occur in relatively shallow sunlit seas. And then down the shallowest part on the canyons units, about 90 meters, and the deeper side of Retriever Seamount, the seamount farthest offshore before you cross onto the international waters, is more than 4,000 meters deep. As Brittany said, both the seamounts and the canyons are adjacent within the monument designation. You get, two things. One, different communities of organisms. And so you get a lot of bang for the buck just because they're very close together, but also because there's a wide range of depths. If you drive up a mountain or climb up a mountain, you go through different life zones. Same thing happens when you're offshore. When you're dropping down through the water, you're essentially climbing mountains in reverse, and you go through different zones across these very high gradients of depth. So you get a lot in terms of biodiversity conservation with this designation. So, threats prior to designation was direct effects of local exploitation, indirect effects of fishing in terms of changing animal interactions and local extinctions of species that are damaged by different kinds of fishing gear. It protects against future undersea mining. You know, the discussion of deep ocean mining is global, looking for rare earth metals to use in production of batteries, et cetera, grinding up the cobalt crusts of seamounts to getting these rare earth metals. So this protects those four seamounts within our EEZ from that activity, as well as potential future mining of methane hydrates. There's methane ice that under low temperatures and high pressures outcrops along the edge of our continental margin, not the seamounts, but through the canyons up and down the eastern seaboard. And so this would protect that part of our continental margin from future mining. And it provides a great reference site for understanding how marine ecosystems work in the absence of those kinds of direct human caused disturbances in the sea.
You mentioned the assfish is a little mushy. Is there any desire to fish for the species anywhere across the globe or any other assfishes?
The density is hugely low, so nobody would go out and target assfish. Back in the 80s, maybe, I was at a meeting on the West Coast. There was some discussion about expanding fisheries for grenadiers, which are similar. I would still stick with Dungeness crab and salmon and things like that. Just saying.
So the Mystic Aquarium, what is their interest in the assfish in terms of research, and what's their role in all of this?
Well, we are the largest natural history attraction in the region outside of Boston. We get almost 1 million visitors a year, and so we are a portal for our guests into what lives in the ocean, from shallow tropical seas to deep sea organisms, along with other sister aquaria, principally New England Aquarium in Boston.
So if I go visit the Mystic Aquarium, am I going to be able to see an assfish in a jar? Or
we have a whole gallery dedicated to the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument and the marine monument system in general. And you can see incredible images of the biodiversity that's represented there. We have no assfish pictures. And we don't have an assfish in a jar yet. But I would imagine that if we got an assfish picture from the monument, we would change that out with something that's already there.
Amazing. What are the biggest questions that still remain about the bony eared assfish that you'd like to see answered?
So one of the things, besides like how its populations persist in this state of extreme local rarity, I think one of the cool things about the assfish is it's got the smallest brain to body size ratio of any vertebrate animal. Now, one might ask, what does it have to know or remember besides eat, poop, reproduce, and don't get eaten? It's obviously not spending a lot of time worrying about stuff. So I think how it does that might be good both from an evolutionary biology perspective, as well as just philosophically for humans. You know, if we can maybe worry less, people might feel better.
Brains are costly to maintain.
Yes, they are.
The ocean is kind of like that last frontier, that area that we feel like we're learning about, but there's still these like big gaps in how we understand different creatures and how they live. Just look at sea turtles, for example. We're still trying to figure out how to age those suckers. Then you think about the stuff that we've done on land and how there's even creatures today that we're still continuing to discover, from like moths to ants to bees. Just keeping that curiosity and sense of wonder alive, I think, is one of the greatest things about the assfish, because we know so little about it. We haven't been down there long enough to really have a real understanding of how these systems work or how these creatures live within their habitat. Maybe that's the best part, maybe that's the worst part. To me, that just creates that mystery to it of like, here's this fish. We know that it was described in 1878, which is just also mind-boggling, that it was found that long ago and identified. But then to this day, we still don't have many records of it. We know it exists. It obviously procreates somewhere along the line. It's really deep and it's got this great name. And it just kind of kept pulling me in as like, what are those mysteries out there that we're just looking to uncover or come across? So that really led to my obsession with the assfish and getting to dig a little deeper into this deep sea world and have that kind of like central species that I can always refer back to. And it's just so much fun to say and a great conversation starter. But I will say it was kind of a trickle effect for my love of other species in the deep marine world that have come up as well, just over my time of serving as a superintendent for the Northeast Canyons and Seamount Marine National Monument. And yeah, just it serves as a good representation of how cool the deep can be.
I think it's really cool how, reading back through the Challenger expedition now 150 years ago, we knew so little about what was out there that people could just go on a trip, just collect, write down a paragraph or so about what they saw, and they could describe thousands of new species this way. And in some ways, I think about like, all right, well, we're well past the days of David Starr Jordan and Gunther, but it's cool to hear your descriptions about these deep sea environments. And really, it still is the unknown, and there's still a lot of work to be done just going out and looking and seeing what's there.
When we started working out on the seamounts, which was only the beginning of the 2000s, we were going to go out and, you know, run these transects over the summits of the seamounts, the ones that are in the monument as well as the ones out to the east. I was going to look at associations between deep sea fishes writ large and corals. Well, it turned out for the corals, we didn't have names for a lot of things. And if you think about the time of the Challenger and some years later, like the Blake expeditions up and down the East Coast, I mean, they were still collecting organisms in the ocean, shallow and deep, by towing dredges on the end of piano wire from a ship. You didn't tow those things over the tops of seamounts very long anyway, because you wouldn't get them back. You know, we're chugging along, and all of a sudden there's this coral 3 meters tall, 9 feet tall, that doesn't have a name. And this is one of the most well-studied parts of the global ocean, so that we can still go out and find big stuff that doesn't have names on it, I think is a testament to, one, how little we know, the role that conservation needs to play in conserving some of these places so we don't destroy our natural heritage. You don't have to go to planets and other galaxies, although that would be very cool. We just need to look beyond our own shoreline to find these places that we know so little about.
Any final messages about why folks listening or people in general should care about the assfish or just the deep waters?
I think we should just tell them that we study assfish so they don't have to.
Well, just to add that, why to care about the deep sea and the assfish or the collection of assfish that might be out there is just that what happens at the deep, what happens to our ocean, happens to us. And so the more we're aware of what's going on with our water, whether that's fresh water or salt water, we have a connection to it. And we all have a role to play in caring for our water systems, from the fresh water to the salt, and how those watersheds work together. And so if you may live far away from the deepest part of the ocean, in the middle of, say, the desert, what you put out on your land, the choices you make as individuals still has a connection to these deep sea creatures. So if they inspire you, if they connect you, if they pull you in some way, just know that everything you do, all these choices we get to make as humans on this planet, has a role to play. And so let that inspiration be the thing that gets you thinking.
Really appreciate having you both on. This was fascinating.
Thank you very much for your interest.
Thank you all for the opportunity to finally talk about the assfish.
Get out there and live with, live from, discover and enjoy all the fish, especially charismatic benthic fauna like the bony-eared assfish and the amazing deep sea that we still don't know a lot about. Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. My name is Katrina Liebeck and my co-host is Guy Uro. Fish of the Week is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region Office of Communications. Our production partner for the series is Citizen Race Car. We honor, thank, and celebrate the whole community, individual tribes, states, our sister agencies, fish enthusiasts, scientists, and others who have elevated our understanding and love as people and professionals of all the fish.